Welcome to Hey Chaplain. My name is Jared Altick, and I'm a chaplain with the police department. I make this podcast so that cops can hear encouragement for the tough work that they do. It's my mission to bring encouragement and wisdom to police officers all around the world. And on this podcast, you'll hear from detectives and dispatchers, U.S. Marshals and county sheriffs, and the occasional lawyer-turned-mafia historian. From the LAPD to Scotland Yard, the guests on Hey Chaplain are giving you the wisdom gleaned from their experiences so that you don't have to do everything the hard way. Today, we're going to take a brief look at the 1933 Kansas City Massacre at Union Station. There is so much to learn by studying criminals and law enforcement from over 90 years ago, and this particular story is a doozy. It touches on half a dozen cities and towns in as many states, involving a couple dozen people, some with personal or criminal connections, and some with no connection at all, who conspire together to commit a crime resulting in a bloody shootout that fundamentally shapes the modern FBI. Our expert today is lawyer and mafia documentarian Terrence O'Malley, who has written books and made documentaries about crime in the 1930s and beyond. Now, we had a wide-ranging conversation, and I had to cut so much of it out, just for fear of information overload, because every single character in this story represents a rabbit trail that you can go down, and each of those could be their own podcast. In fact, let me recommend the Gangland Wire podcast by my other lawyer-turned-mafia historian friend, Gary Jenkins. But today, we're going to sit at the feet of Mr. O'Malley as he unpacks the complicated timeline that led to mafia hitmen and bank robbers killing cops and federal agents in 1933 Kansas City. Here's Terrence O'Malley. Hello, Terrence. How are you today?
I'm fine, Jared. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so glad to get to talk about this story with you. Can you tell me, how did you get interested in mafia history and crime in the 1930s? How did you get interested in this?
Well, it really stemmed from my great-great-aunt, who is Nellie Don, and she was kidnapped in 1931 and held ransom, and she was rescued by the mafia. Oh, and wow. So as I was doing research on Nellie Don, I always knew that she had been kidnapped, but I didn't realize that Johnny Lazzia and his gang had saved her from the kidnappers, the people that kidnapped her. So in the Nellie Don story, the mafia are the good guys.
Oh, wow.
But what occurred to me was, while I was doing my research, and this was in the early 2000s, that there had never, been a good written treatment of the mafia in Kansas City, and there certainly had not been any film treatment of the mafia in Kansas City. So I immediately set about researching Black Hand Straw Man, the history of organized crime in Kansas City, and that is both the name of my, you know, feature-length documentary film and also a book, which is unlike any other book about the mafia, because it's a graphical depiction of the mob. And it spans from 1910 to 1986. And Black Hand is the early extortionary period of Sicilian upon Sicilian crime. And then the Straw Man is the FBI code name that they gave to the skimming of the casinos in Las Vegas in the 70s and early 80s. And so it was while I was doing that research, I wasn't really sure that I was going to include the Union Station Massacre in either of my works, my film or my book, until I came to find out that the solution to the Union Station Massacre was directly linked to organized crime in Kansas City, and then come to find out that the Lazzia gang was intimately involved in the Union Station Massacre.
Wow.
So that's okay. Kind of how my interest in it developed.
No, that's fantastic. So set the stage for me. I need a run-up to the Kansas City Massacre at Union Station. So
sure.
Who was Frank Nash, and what was going on with him and his associates?
Well, you know, Frank Nash is a fascinating criminal character because he made the transcendence from robbing trains on horseback to robbing banks in cars with Thompson machine guns.
Wow.
And he was named Frank Jelly Nash, and the jelly comes from the fact that he was a pretty good with explosives, and he knew how to use nitroglycerin to blow up vaults at banks. And he was serving time at the federal penitentiary in Leavenworth because he had robbed a U.S. mail train. And on October 19th, 1930, he escaped from Leavenworth Prison. Now, I should say that he was a trustee at that time, and a trustee is a person to whom trust is given, and he was actually working in the assistant warden's house in the kitchen when he simply just walked off the job. He took the complete works of Shakespeare, and he stole that from the library, and then he walked off the job, and so he was then a fugitive.
Okay, so, and he had been in trouble with the law. In fact, I did a little bit of research
all his life.
He had been arrested for serious crimes and then pardoned.
Oh, yeah, murder.
Yeah.
He'd been arrested for murder. He and another guy in Oklahoma, he was from Oklahoma, they were sent up to a prison on homicide charges.
Yep.
That's where he met this guy named Deffy Farmer, who comes into play in the Union Station Massacre. I tell people all the time, the Union Station Massacre story, it has so many different characters that are involved with it. I mean, literally, there's probably at least 20 people that are involved with the thing.
Yeah.
So it's not a narrative that easily lends itself to simple explication, but we're going to do the best job we can. And so the date now is June 16th, 1933. Mm-hmm. And Jelly has been, Frank Nash, Jelly Nash, has been residing down in Hot Springs, Arkansas, which was a notorious haven for low-level criminals to hide away, to lay low.
It's kind of off the grid a little bit.
Yeah, right? A little bit. I mean, yeah. J. Edgar Hoover came up with this corridor of crime in the 30s, and it basically was a swath from Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, and then it bled over into the eastern central states, Indiana, Illinois, and then up into Michigan and Wisconsin. It was just that's where a lot of the well-known and notorious gangsters perpetrated their crimes. I mean, if you were to name them, Machine Gun Kelly, Babyface Nelson,
Bonnie
and Clyde, the Barker Gang, Pretty Boy Floyd. So, you know, all these rogue gangsters who were not part of organized crime, they were basically robbing banks up and down the Midwest. And one of the reasons why they could do it in the Midwest as opposed to, say, doing it like out in Arizona or New Mexico is that in, like for Kansas and Missouri, for instance, there are so many what they call cat's roads. In other words, only a cat can see the road at night. And so they would make these getaway sheets for these bank robberies. They would have it very meticulously planned out to where, you know, they would say, okay, you go 3/4 of a mile, then you turn left into this farm road, and then you go 1/8 of a mile, you turn right. And, you know, they would have these complex ways of getting away from law enforcement, whereas, you know, in the open plains, you know, back in Arizona or in, even in West Texas and places where it's more wide open, you couldn't get away as easily.
Sure, they see you.
So they like to come up into the central United States because of the lanes of traffic. And then also Kansas City was particularly well favored by these criminals because it was run by the corrupt political machine of the Pendergasts. Mm-hmm. And so it was a safe haven because Pendergast and his political cronies had a deal basically with the mafia, which is we'll let you run your sin businesses for exchange of keeping, you know, major crime down. You know, we don't care if you run your gambling joints and your prostitution, but we don't want shootouts in the street, and we don't want bank robberies, and, you know, we don't want homicides and all that kind of stuff. So that was kind of the scenario on June 16th, 1933. And at this time, Frank Jelly Nash has been living down in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Okay. So he has already been arrested, sentenced, and pardoned for multiple crimes. He's a bank robber.
he was serving like a 25-year sentence at the time that he walked off from the assistant warden. So,
and he was actually helping other people escape prison too, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a sidebar to what we're talking about here, but. Sure. Yeah, Frank Nash, he helped orchestrate an escape from Lansing Prison up there in Leavenworth while he was out.
Yeah.
So he, you know, Frank Nash was a professional criminal. He had a real garrulous personality. He was very personable. He was likable. He was the life of the party. He was a fun guy to hang out with. And so he was popular among everybody. Yeah, Frank's a nice guy. He knows how to go along and get along. But he's at his inner core, he's just been a thief for all his life. And he doesn't ever plan on holding a job. That's just not going to happen. And so, you know, he's going to have to perpetrate, you know, crime. And so he's living with his girlfriend down there in Hot Springs when two federal agents and a sheriff from Oklahoma, who was brought along to identify him, arrest him at it's called the White Front Cigar Store. And Nash was wearing a wig and sporting a mustache, but that's why they brought along Otto Reed, who was the police chief from McAllister, Oklahoma, which was like right around where Frank was from in Oklahoma. So they nabbed him.
Right.
And it was quite a commotion because the sheriff down there in Hot Springs was corrupt. Mm. You know, the FBI guys had to get him out of town before they could set up a roadblock to block the road to protect them from taking, you know, spiriting,
right,
you know, Frank Nash away. The guy who owned the White Front Cigar Store was named Richard Galatis. And so he chartered a monoplane to take Frank's putative wife, and I say putative because Frank was a bigamist, and her name was Frances Nash, and she had a daughter named Danella. And so this guy named Richard Galatis, who had befriended Frank Nash and who owned the White Front Cigar Store, chartered a flight from Hot Springs up to Joplin, Missouri, because that's where they were supposed to be taking Frank through, because they thought they were going to drive all the way from Hot Springs to Joplin, Missouri, up to Kansas City. Mm-hmm. Well, the federal agents changed their minds and decided that they would hop a train in Fort Smith and take the train up to Kansas City. Okay. Now, at this time in Missouri, you have Pretty Boy Floyd, who is the subject of a massive manhunt in Missouri because a state trooper has just recently been killed.
Yeah.
And they think that Pretty Boy Floyd did that.
Okay.
Now, on the morning of June 16th, Pretty Boy Floyd and his alcoholic sidekick, Adam Ricchetti, some people pronounce it Ricchetti, they were in the Bitzer car dealership down in Bolivar, Missouri, and they were having their car worked on because Ricchetti's brother worked there at the car dealership. And so they were having their car worked on when in strolled Sheriff Jack Killingsworth of Bolivar, Missouri. He just went in for a cup of coffee and to shoot the breeze, you know, in the morning. Right. And Adam Ricchetti, being in a semi-intoxicated state, he freaked out and he pulled a gun out and said, "That's the law." Well, next thing you know, Pretty Boy Floyd's there and he pulls a machine gun out. So now they're holding guns on the sheriff.
Right.
And so then they kidnap the sheriff and they commandeer like the best car there at the dealership. And they start making their way up to Kansas City along the Cat Road.
At this point, does Floyd already know about Nash's arrest?
No. They didn't know each other from Adam. They knew nothing about each other.
Really?
They probably, Nash may have heard of Pretty Boy Floyd because of his notoriety.
Right.
But nobody knew who Frank Nash was. I mean, he was a low-level, you know, run-of-the-mill criminal, basically. You know, he wasn't any celebrated gangster or anything like that. I mean, he had his people, you know, those close associates that he had robbed banks with and perpetrated crimes, but you know, these people tend not to talk about what they're doing. Right. You know, I mean, more people know what you're doing, the more likely you're going to get caught. So, you know, they don't have like this huge wide swath of, you know, associates like in organized crime.
Right. The FBI is taking Nash up to Kansas City by train.
Right.
The Pretty Boy Floyd is, and his associates are traveling by car, by a series of stolen cars, to Kansas City.
Right. And along the way, they're holding Jack Killingsworth, the sheriff of Bolivar.
Yeah, they got a sheriff hostage, at least part of the way.
They got a sheriff hostage, which not the brightest thing in the world. And then also, they commandeer a businessman's car, and they take him hostage as well.
Oh, I didn't know about that one. So they're on this collision course for Kansas City. How did these two groups, the FBI is on their way to Kansas City, and ultimately, on the way back to the penitentiary in Leavenworth, right?
Right. Okay. Definitely, they're taking him back to Leavenworth.
So they're on their way through Kansas City to Leavenworth by train. And so the big train station in Kansas City is Union Station. It's big, tall, one of the big, great American train stations. You know, huge, you know, 80-foot ceilings and that kind of thing. So they're going to go through there, but Pretty Boy Floyd and his associates are also coming through Kansas City. How do the two interact? How does Floyd get the idea that he's going to rescue Nash?
Pretty Boy Floyd and Adam Ricchetti, they make their way up into the Kansas City West Bottoms, which at that time was the industrial center. Heavy industry center of Kansas City. And they got dropped off at like, I think, 12th and Hickory Street. And they made a phone call, and a car came around for them about 15 or 20 minutes later and picked them up. And so Adam Ricchetti and Pretty Boy Floyd were given safe harbor in Kansas City.
Okay.
And they were given the safe harbor by Dominic Benaggio is his name, and he owned the Sexton Hotel, and he ran a horror house out of it, and it was a speakeasy, and it was a criminal outfit.
Okay.
His younger brother was Charles Benaggio, who would later become infamous due to not only the fact that he was a bona fide mafioso, but he also was the victim of an assassination, which basically gave rise to the Kefauver Committee hearings here in Kansas City and around the country.
Okay.
So, but this is the brother of, and these guys are no shrinking violets. I mean, Dominic Benaggio was arrested for shotgunning a guy to death in his own bar. You know, these guys been around the block a couple of times. Charlie Benaggio was probably on site when Pretty Boy Floyd had a shootout on Independence Avenue. Okay. Pretty Boy Floyd killed a federal agent, a prohibition agent. That was some time before. He always comes back to Kansas City, though.
Yeah.
It's this weird attraction that he's got to Kansas City.
But if you're running from the law, you might feel safe in a large, corrupt city.
In Kansas City.
Right.
It's a big enough city to get lost, and it's also got formal protection by corrupt politicians. So, no, it's a good city. So Adam Ricchetti and Pretty Boy Floyd get picked up in the West Bottoms by Dominic Benaggio or one of his people, and word reaches Johnny Lazia, who is the head of the mob in Kansas City at this time, who's the big boss, who definitely is the number one guy in Kansas City. And he's holding court down at the Harvey restaurant at Union Station. Hmm. Lazia gets a phone call from Dominic Benaggio saying, "Hey, Pretty Boy Floyd is in town, and I'm taking care of him. He's under my control." Lazia goes, "Okay, fine. Thanks for letting me know, you know, or at least this is what we think happened."
Right.
Then Galatis, who had chartered that flight to Joplin with Frank Nash's putative wife, Frances Nash, and her daughter, well, they came to find out that the lawmen were not bringing, you know, were not driving through Joplin, but instead, were going to be on the train to Kansas City, and they were meeting a guy named Deffy Farmer. They were staying at Deffy Farmer. That's who Frank Nash had served time with in Oklahoma. You can see how this story gets so crazy.
Yeah.
Well, Deffy Farmer and his wife gave safe harbor to Francis Nash and to her daughter and to this Richard Gallatus. And they find out that they're not coming by through car. So they know that Frank Nash's good friend, Vern Miller, who was a hitman for the Purple Gang in Detroit, and he was a hitman for Murder Incorporated, and he was also a hitman for the Capone Organization. And he and Frank were really good friends. They hit it off, which is really interesting because this guy, Vern Miller, who was living under an alias in Kansas City, Missouri, he was not like Frank Nash. He was not garrulous. He was reticent. He was really conservative. He didn't like people cussing around women. He was uptight, kind of, you know, standoffish. What happens is this Richard Gallatus calls this mobster up in Chicago who owns a bar that they all hung out at. Anyway, they call up to Louis Doc Stacy, who ran this bar in Chicago where they all used to hang out. And they said, we're trying to get hold of Vern Miller. So Doc Stacy contacts Vern Miller, who gets hold of his girlfriend.
And they're trying to get a hold of Miller, the hitman, to try to rescue Nash?
Yes. Yes. Because Miller is a really good friend with Frank.
Okay.
And so Doc Stacy gets hold of Vivian Mathias, who then gets hold of Vern Miller, who's out on a golf course. And so Vern Miller says, okay, I'll take care of it. I'll take care of it. So this is the connection you got. He gets nabbed in Hot Springs, Arkansas. His wife and the owner of the cigar store fly a plane up to Joplin. They stay with Deffy Farmer and his wife. They call up to Doc Stacy in Chicago, who then gets hold of Vivian Mathias, who is Vern Miller's girlfriend, who gets hold of Vern Miller. And Vern Miller goes down to Union Station to visit Johnny Lazia. He goes and he finds Johnny Lazia at the Harvey restaurant in Union Station. Mm-hmm. And he explains to Lazia, he says, hey, I need some men and I need some guns because I want to liberate my friend, Frank Nash, who they're going to be bringing in through the train tomorrow morning.
This is a plausible plan because FBI agents were relatively soft targets, at least some of them.
They were. And, okay. And it's not really the FBI at this time.
Okay.
I mean, that's one of the important things that comes out of this event is that it really gave birth to the modern FBI. And I don't care what they say about killers of the Flower Moon or whatever
right,
it is.
Right.
FBI agents always had jurisdiction over Indian affairs on reservations. Bureau agents mm-hmm. did. And then also they had jurisdiction over federal escaped convicts. Okay. So they're also prohibition enforcement. But their jurisdiction was very limited. And so what happened was you had about 12 pieces of legislation emanate from the Union Station within a year of the Union Station massacre. It basically gave J. Edgar Hoover the excuse that he needed to get a bunch of laws passed. And that really is what gave birth to the modern FBI. And it became an official bureau at that time. Johnny Lazia gets approached by Vern Miller, who's all in a, frizzy over, you know, the fact that he's got to rescue this guy coming through tomorrow morning. He needs men and he needs gun. And Lazia says, no, I'm not going to give you any of my men. But Pretty Boy Floyd just got in town. How would you like to use him?
Okay.
Vern Miller said, fine. So Lazia had his men, Sammy the Hog, and maybe a Gargata or a Corollo. So that's what happened is Vern Miller went down to see Johnny Lazia at the Harvey restaurant, implored him to give him men and guns to help release Frank Nash. Lazia declines, but he says, hey, I'll hook you up with Pretty Boy Floyd. So that's how the nexus was made. Vern Miller did not know Pretty Boy Floyd or Adam Ricchetti and they never had anything to do with each other.
How much time do they have? The Kansas City Mafia gives Pretty Boy Floyd to Miller, the hitman. They're going to rescue Nash. How much time do they have before the train arrives?
Oh, they had all evening.
Okay.
You know, the train arrived at like 7:15 in the morning.
Okay.
And there's multiple witnesses who, like, they saw, you know, Ricchetti and Pretty Boy Floyd hanging around Union Station. They saw that.
Okay.
Otto Reed, the sheriff from McAlester, Oklahoma, he had a specially designed shotgun or altered shotgun where every time you engaged a shell, it shot.
Oh, wow.
You know, boom, 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 right? He and another federal agent named Joe Lackey, they ended up picking up the wrong guns, each other's guns.
Oh, my.
Okay, when they got off the train.
Okay.
So Lackey ended up picking up Sheriff Reed's gun, shotgun.
Which will go off as soon as you rack a shell.
Right. Exactly right. Frank Nash had his hands manacled, and they had like a handkerchief over his hands so that you couldn't see the handcuffs. And I think it was just so as not to, you know, scare people as they walk through. But I mean, they had this like wedge going through the terminal. You had the three arresting officers, Frank Smith, Otto Reed, and the other one was Joe Lackey. Then they met up with four more lawmen here in Kansas City that morning.
Okay.
So the three guys on the train met four more lawmen. Those were Kansas City police officer Herman Red Grooms, federal agent Raymond F. Caffrey, Lieutenant Frank Hermanson of the Kansas City Police Department, and then there was another guy named Reed Vetterly, who was of the Bureau. They escort Frank Nash with his hands covered out to Agent Caffrey's automobile. Agent Caffrey hadn't been here in Kansas City that long. I think he'd only been here for a matter of months from the FBI office, right? And as is Reed Vetterly. They go out to the automobile of Agent Caffrey, and it was a two-door. So the first person to get in is Joe Lackey, and he gets into the far back left seat, okay, behind the driver. Then Frank Nash starts to get in, and he starts getting into the back, and Lackey says, "No, no, no, you sit up front so we can keep our eyes on you," just like we did coming out of Hot Springs. So that's the way they had it set up. Frank Nash was in the front passenger seat, but he had scooted over almost where he was sitting in the driver's seat because they had to push the, you know, the front seat up so that other people could get in the back of the car. So yeah. So Frank Smith gets into the middle of the back seat, and Otto Reed gets in behind the passenger in the back seat of the car. And then outside the car, you still have Reed Vetterly, Officer Herman Red Grooms, Raymond Caffrey, and Frank Hermanson. So you still have four cops that were outside. Okay. So by this time, you got three agents, there were three that are in the back seat, and you got Frank Nash in the front seat, when all of a sudden they are descended upon by Pretty Boy Floyd, Vern Miller, and Adam Ricchetti. And, you know, what is written is that the bad guys, you know, closed in on them and said, up, put them up with their guns. Mm-hmm. Well, Lackey is in the back seat, and he can see that they're being descended upon by, you know, the criminals. So he pulls up Otto Reed's gun.
Modified shotgun. Yeah.
And he engages a shell, and it goes off, and it blows Frank Nash's head off. And a pellet that Otto Reed used to load his own guns hit the side temple of Agent Caffrey. Mm. Just one little piece of homemade buckshot. And it was enough to enter into his skull, and it killed him. And it's probably likely that Lackey still had not figured out what was going on with the gun because he engaged it again.
Ah.
And so it went off again. And they think, and it's probably true, that one of the officers standing outside was probably killed again by friendly fire.
Oh, wow.
So you probably have at least two cops that were killed by friendly fire. But of course, once the shooting started, then, you know, the bad guys, you know, they got Thompson machine guns. They just they just start shooting like crazy. And Adam Ricchetti had a pistol and he's shooting like crazy. Outside of the car, Frank Hermanson was killed and Red Grooms was killed. And in the back seat of the automobile, Police Chief Otto Reed was killed. Frank Smith played Possum, as did Lackey, the two other men sitting in the back seat, so that when the shooting stopped, it was probably Vern Miller who came around and looked at Nash and said, "He's dead. Yeah. Let's get out of here." And they roared off into history from there. There was an officer at Union Station who fired some shots at their fleeing car. That's the incident, if you will.
Let me move, because I know there's a lot more to the story as far as the capture of Pretty Boy Floyd, or the attempted capture, and the end of all these other individuals. But I'm going to leave that out there for people to pursue on their own, to look up your resources and such. But the takeaway is, what changed for the FBI?
Hoover was able to use this incident, along with several other incidents, and then, of course, just crying about all of these rogue gangsters that are out there. I mean, you still got Bonnie and Clyde running around, and you got Babyface Nelson and of course, Pretty Boy Floyd and John Dillinger and, all these rogue gangsters running around, and the FBI's jurisdiction was limited. So basically what it did was it really made the FBI a true police force.
Yeah.
Before, they were just kind of this, ensemble of, do-gooding agents. But here they actually became cops.
Yeah. Now they had the power to arrest and to
and carry firearms.
Yeah. Yeah.
Execute warrants.
Yeah.
Their jurisdiction was expanded off the reservation and, across all states.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
they now
have
a literally
federal police force now.
Yeah. That's basically what they became.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Through a series of legislation that Roosevelt was more than happy to sign into law.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, yeah. Tell me, like I said, these guys are interesting. And the further you dig into it, you just keep turning up more names. There are bank robbers and mafioso and all kinds of different types of people involved in this. And every one of them is a rabbit trail that you can just pursue.
Yeah.
And it's just endlessly fascinating. What resources have you created that people could maybe find?
Oh, well, I mean, specific to this subject matter, my book, Black Hand Straw Man, The History of Organized Crime, would be a great resource for anybody. And then also it is a feature-length documentary film, Black Hand Straw Man, The History of Organized Crime. The solution to the Union Station massacre was not easily stumbled upon, because they couldn't figure out what would Vern Miller and Pretty Boy Floyd have in common. They had nothing in common. They had never run together. They didn't know each other. So why would these two people be together? So from the FBI's perspective, it made no sense. But the reason why they were able to solve it was because of the assassination of Johnny Lazio. Hmm. And I'll just leave it at that.
Excellent. Oh, great. Great stuff to go look up and disappear down the rabbit hole chasing that information. That's fantastic. Well, Terrence, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming and talking about this. I know this is a great teaser for probably years of research and reading books and just digging into all this information, historical information. It's fantastic.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Very much.
Thank you so much. I want to thank Terrence for coming on the show, because as I look around at the floor of the cutting room, there are so many other podcast episodes here, and I need to have him back. I'm amused by the connection between lawyers and crime historians, as the two jobs seem to overlap quite a bit. It seems that if you can understand and then explain to a jury the timeline of all the random weird connections and motivations that come with criminal activity, then you're probably the right one to explain it to the rest of us also. I just appreciate so much that I can call on experts like Terrence to shine light on these amazing stories from almost a century ago. On the next episode of Hey Chaplain.
And we got there, and the guy was still there. He walks out with a gun in his hand and said, "I did it." You know, but that really didn't hit me, though, until a little bit further in the night when I actually walked through their house. And that's when I started looking through, and I'm looking at, you know, dishes in the sink that were undone, pictures on the wall, and clothing, laundry that needed to be folded, things like that. And it really, for some reason, that really hit me hard. This lady was not ready to leave this earth, you know, there were a lot of things that were undone. And when she got up and got ready to go to work that day, she had no idea that was her last day.
Would you like to help me encourage police officers? If you would, please go to buymeacoffee.com/heychaplain. Listeners donate a $5 virtual coffee through that website, and you don't have to do that. You already get the show for free. But thank you for making it possible for police officers to hear something positive. The views expressed here are the personal views of the host and our guest and do not necessarily represent the views of any law enforcement agency or its components. If you like this episode, please share it with a cop or someone who loves a cop. Thank you for listening to Hey Chaplain, and as always, pray for peace in our city.